Hello, it's John Hodgson. I'm back again with Jonathan Brown. It's part two of his autobiography, and it's absolutely fascinating. And from what he's been saying, whilst we've just been having a break, there's an awful lot of more interesting things to come. So, Jonathan, can I send you back to your autobiography and fill us in from there, please?
Right. Well, I started working as a school caretaker at Colden School, and the headmistress was Connie Earnshaw.
Connie.
Yeah, good. Yeah. You know, who lived in Walston.
Yes.
She was a very good headmistress. Mm. And she was interested in what we were doing with the small holding. You know, yeah. She was interested in the countryside. And she got on well with our children who went to Colden School. And then when the caretaker left, she asked me if I would cover, you know, until they found somebody else. And because I needed to earn money, and I was trying to earn money, you know, building walls or doing... you know, labouring work or just this, that and the other. But being a permanent school caretaker seemed a much better way of earning a living because it was, you know, 52 weeks a year,
a steady job.
Mm. And also, I had to take the children to school anyway. So I had to be at the school anyway at those times, you know, so I thought that would
work very well. Mm-hmm.
So I started off, and my first job was to clean the school from top to bottom over the summer, you know, while it was...
Yes, it was 6 weeks. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know a great deal about cleaning. The only thing I knew about was vim. And my idea was that to do the cleaning, you needed some vim and a scrubbing brush.
Yeah.
And, you know, and, yeah. But I soon realised that really, you know, things have moved on a lot since then. And what people want now, they want a vinyl floor, which is highly polished, that you can see your face in and that smells nice. They don't want to smell vim. You know, I had to learn a bit about being the caretaker and also knowing which key opened every door. Mm-hmm. And some doors you could only open from one side. If you tried to open them from the other side, the lock would get jammed, you know, so
wonderful.
Lots of things. And then
the
boiler was always a big issue because you can imagine during the winter, Colden School would be perishing if there was no heating up there.
Yeah.
And the boiler was down some steps underneath the school. So if there was a lot of rain, the water would go down these steps and build up, and if it got to a certain height, it would knock out the boiler, the control panel. So then, when I got there in the morning, there'd be no heat, you know. So then,
and you'd be knee deep in water.
And you know, so then the school would have to get portable gas heaters or something if they wanted to keep it open.
Yeah.
You know.
Goodness me.
So things like that, and also, the caretaker, they didn't have fancy thermostats then. You just had to judge what time you thought the heating should go off on that particular day, depending on what the weather looked like, you know. So you might set it so it went off at 12 o'clock because, you know, obviously the residual heat stays in to keep the building warm.
Yeah.
But some of the teachers didn't appreciate that. Some teachers would go mad at you if they heard that the heating had gone
off. They'd gone off, yes. I'm going home.
So there was that. Mrs. Earnshaw, as I say, was a very good headmistress, and she left after I'd been there a short time, and they got another head teacher who was an absolute liability. You know, school started at 9:15, and sometimes he wouldn't appear until 9:15, and then he'd grab the bell on his way in and shake it.
Wonderful.
So this man was the absolute opposite of
Mrs. Earnshaw.
And when he was there, the school was more chaotic, you know, than if he wasn't there.
Yes.
But because it was only a small school with three teachers, without an efficient head teacher, the place just couldn't operate properly.
You know? No, that's right. Anarchy,
Anyway, so he lasted a couple of years, and then Tony Greenwood took over.
Yes.
He was a very capable man, and he actually continued to be the head teacher there for 30 years.
Yes, he was there a long time, I remember. Yeah.
Now, when Tony Greenwood's predecessor was there, he had the job of appointing a new teacher, a part-time teacher, and he should have appointed a teacher who could play the piano because they didn't have anybody to play the piano, the last teacher having left who could play the piano. Mm. But for some reason, this headmaster, he took a fancy to this particular lady who he wanted to appoint.
Yeah.
He didn't play the piano, so he said that he would take over the piano playing duties, you know, and he'd appoint this lady. But then it turned out that his idea of playing the piano was just he'd ignore all the sharps and flats and play everything as if it was in C. you know, and play as quietly as possible, yeah. So nobody could tell what it actually sounded like.
Yes, oh boy.
So anyway, so that meant that when Tony Greenwood arrived,
yeah.
There was nobody who could play the piano.
Right.
And I've always enjoyed playing the piano, but I'd never played really in public, so mm-hmm. I agreed to play for the Harvest Festival. And Tony Greenwood looked a bit dubious. He said, you know, well, I suppose, you know, if it goes wrong, we can always just sing without accompaniment or something.
He
didn't really boost my confidence. But so I had these seven, you know, songs and hymns that I had to learn to play for the Harvest Festival.
Yeah.
And I practiced and practiced and practiced. Because one thing about being a cleaner is that practicing the piano is more enjoyable than cleaning. So, you know, I always could take a break and enjoy playing the piano, because often the reason people don't make progress is because
they don't.
The practice is boring, but compared to cleaning, the practice wasn't boring. So I had these five songs that I had to perfect, you know, for the Harvest Festival. And I was getting quite, you know, I was practicing hours each day and still making mistakes. And I thought, what am I going to do? You know, I practiced like mad. And, and then gradually I was practicing for about 6 weeks. And then eventually I thought, it's coming together now. I think I'll be able to manage it. And
good.
Of course, they have a rehearsal, so that was the kind of critical thing.
Yes.
If I could get through the rehearsal, then
you were made.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when you actually do it, the other thing was I got children to join in with percussion instruments and recorders.
Oh, yeah.
So I made a little band, you know, because that supported me. It made it more fun. And the children enjoyed it too. And also the parents and the audience, it was more enjoyable for them, you know, so everybody was happy.
It was a bold step for you to take.
And that was the time when keyboards had come in, you know, electronic keyboards.
Right.
So I copied the kind of beats that they had on these simple keyboards and divided percussion instruments among the children to imitate these beats.
The beats?
You know.
Oh, right.
And that worked. So, and then the feedback was so good that I continued doing that and started a music group for the children with another lady who was teaching recorder on a voluntary basis at the school. So that was a whole new hobby then for me. And we called it the music group, and we'd do concerts, you know, and we'd, children would be really enthusiastic.
We'd
meet after school on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
That kind of gave me a very fulfilling hobby, and it meant that in the morning, you know, you can imagine, in the morning the caretaker goes and unlocks everything and goes around cleaning everything and all that, and then slinks away, you know, when everybody comes. Mm. But it meant that I, rather than slinking away, I could then play something in assembly, you know, whatever song they wanted to sing, with the children accompanying, you know, they were playing their percussion instruments and their recorders.
Start the day on a high note.
Start the day on a high note, sort of like, you know, leaving after a little performance, so it was...
Oh, they look forward to that.
So that was really enjoyable. And then I ended up, when children got keyboards for Christmas, I offered to show them how to use them, you know, and then I ended up giving music lessons as a sideline.
Mm.
So that, again, became quite a big sideline, you know.
It must have done,
but just doing it locally.
Yeah. So you eventually you would stop being the caretaker, I guess, so...
Well, no.
No?
I mean, I had to keep going as the caretaker, but I realised I needed to retrain to get a proper job.
Right.
And one day I came into Todmorden, and in Todmorden Library they had a display about the profession of occupational therapy.
Oh, yes.
And there was a lady who worked, you know, at the upper centre where they used to have a day hospital in Todmorden.
Oh, the Abram Armroad Centre, yes.
So I asked if I could go there to have a word with this lady who'd organised this little exhibition in the library. Because every year they have this OT week, you know, where occupational therapists put up some kind of display to attract people or try and interest people in the profession.
I see. So it attracted you?
Yes, so it attracted me. So I went to the Abraham Ormerod. She said, yeah, you're welcome to come. You know, come for a whole day and see exactly what we do.
Yes,
you know?
I see.
And then I had to do some training, you know, because to apply to become, you know, it was a 3-year degree course, and I had to show evidence of recent academic ability in order to get on the course.
Right.
So I did an open university course on health and disease. And then my mother had been working with the CAB, so I thought that would be useful training as well. So I volunteered with the Todmorden CAB.
Oh, yes.
You know, when they were...
But you weren't still caretaking all this time?
Well, I was initially, yes. Yeah, because I had to get I had to get on this training course before I could stop being the caretaker.
It's difficult, isn't it? Yeah.
I went on an evening class, you know, to gain some counselling skills and to get qualified so I could, or at least show I was interested in these things so I could stand a chance of getting on the course.
Right.
So that's what I did. I was accepted to go on the course in York.
Yes.
And so that's when I stopped being the school caretaker and started the occupational therapy course in York.
So that would be obviously a full-time course. And
Then I continued doing the music lessons because that financed, in a way that financed, I mean, I got a small grant, but doing the music lessons part-time over the weekends meant I could have some extra money, you know, for the family and things.
Yeah.
So I did that.
So where did you have these lessons? Because you wouldn't be connected to school now, I guess.
No, well, I went around people's homes.
I see.
I found it worked better because people didn't have to drop their kids off somewhere and then pick them up. It meant I'd just come around to their house.
Right.
And a lot of them were people who lived on the hilltops, you know, or people who...
Yeah.
But I didn't have to advertise much. I found just word of mouth. And there'd be lots of people who, you know, would be phoning up.
Yeah.
And so I'd, you know, slot them in.
So this funded you all the way through your course then,
did
it?
Yes.
So, and having qualified?
And then when I qualified, I got a job as a community occupational therapist in Rochdale.
Right.
I still kept doing the music lessons because, you know, once you start, a lot of people just want to keep doing it.
So
I did keep doing it for quite a long time. So, yeah, so I ended up, you know, being a 9-to-5 occupational therapist in Rochdale. And then when I started the training course, I sold the cows and the sheep and rented the land out, you know, the 22 acres that we had by then. So it's been rented out ever since.
I see, but you don't have those acres now? That you...
Well, my wife still lives up there.
I see.
So she's still up there and gets the rent for the acres up there. But I'm separate, I'm divorced.
Yes.
Now, I moved to Hebden Bridge 10 years ago. And I now live in Melbourne Street in an overdwelling, a back-to-back overdwelling.
Right, yes.
And I've got this little B&B, you know, business
with
a single ensuite room.
Oh, yeah.
And we cater particularly, well, for people travelling on their own, because often people have to pay a premium. You know, if they're travelling on their own, they have to pay a premium to stay in a twin room or a
tiny
box room.
Yeah.
So we wanted to have somewhere, you know, that was just geared to somebody travelling on their own. So it's got a desk, a nice comfortable chair, plenty of room, a nice big shower, you know.
Oh, lovely.
And beautiful views.
Yeah,
you know,
from up there, right.
Yeah, so that works well.
So this is what you're doing now?
Yeah, one of the things.
That's only one of the things, I know, go on.
I still play the piano, but instead of working with 8-year-olds, I now work with 80-year-olds,
right,
you know, and rather than playing recorder, they're singing, you know, and we're doing but the same kind of music that I've always enjoyed, you know, the popular, more popular music.
So does this mean you got an 80-year-old choir?
Well, I mean, you have to be over 55 to join the choir,
but
some of them are in their 90s, you know, we had a lady who was 100 who was in the choir, you know,
wonderful.
So it's quite a big age spread when you think 55 upwards, you know, it covers a lot of people.
Yes.
It's like Todd Corr, isn't it?
Yes, it
is,
yeah.
It covers a wide age range.
So you were telling me earlier that you've got this little choir, but you also play for the residents at Mytham?
Well, the choir, they perform at Mytham Meadows. They do little concerts there. So we do 17 songs and then five of them, we invite the audience to join in with and we give them the words, you know, so they can join in.
A bit of community singing.
Yes, yes.
Oh, they will enjoy that. Of course they will.
Yeah, but first, you know, when you move down, people who live on the tops, they're a bit snobbish about it, you know, they think, oh, I'd never want to live in the bottom, not in the... Look down, right down there, it's like the bottom of the well in Hebden Bridge. You'd want to live down there with all that traffic and, you know, and everything else. But now I'm very content to be in Hebden Bridge, because I can go up on the hilltops when the weather's nice, but you know, I prefer being near the Co-op and all the Modcons.
And near the Fox and Goose. And
well, you know, but I don't need a car. If you're on the tops, you have to have,
have a car.
Every time you go out, you need the car, you know, pretty much.
So. Well, there you go, you see. Now, I said at the beginning, didn't I, that you were one of these men that got things done, and you've proved my point beautifully. I'm going to hand you back to Jonathan, and he's going to do a sales pitch now to give details of how you can get in touch with Jonathan and his bed and breakfast business.
Right. Well, our attic B&B is a single ensuite room, and it's in Melbourne Street, number 23 Melbourne Street in central Hebden Bridge. And it's up two flights of stairs in the attic. And the attic is very wide. It's about 19 feet wide. And it's got its own stairs and its own door at the bottom, which can be locked. So it has, you know, privacy.
I see.
There's a good sized shower there, good, you know, lovely views, two very big Velux windows, so it's very light. Oh. We offer bed and breakfast at £40 a night, but then we give a 10% discount for subsequent nights. People can contact us on Facebook or by email at jonathan195137@hotmail.com, or they can telephone on my landline 01422 845 688, or send me a text or call me on my mobile phone 07887 818 880.
Well, Jonathan, thanks ever so much for that. That's been absolutely marvellous. Thank you. And I hope everybody's enjoyed this as much as I have. Right, thanks.